We didn't get all that far in terms of slides through this chapter, but those were some slides that took a little longer. We're up to slide 6, I believe, and we're looking at a couple cells here to illustrate a dichotomy of cell types within biology. Now, what is a dichotomy, just in general terms? What does that word mean? Yeah.
I believe it's kind of like a structure, kind of a format of, I would say, organism or just anything non-living as well.
Yeah, but what does di mean as a prefix? It means two. A dichotomy is a two-part way of looking at something. And so there are fundamentally two different types of cells or categories of cells in biology. And those are called prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. Oh, those words are up here. I don't need to write them. Notice that they share the karyo root, K-A-R-Y-O, which is a word that means kernel or the core of something, the most important part, the core, the kernel. Pro, as in prokaryote, means before. The kernel or the core of a cell, if it has one, is its nucleus. And so karyo specifically refers in cells to nucleus. And prokaryotic, therefore, means cells that existed before the nucleus evolved, and they therefore don't have a nucleus. Now, there are still prokaryotic cells. They were the original cells, and they have always been the most successful cells in terms of numbers that there are. Most organisms alive, which are bacteria, are prokaryotic. We just kind of forget about them because we don't see them with the naked eye, but they're everywhere that life is. Everywhere that is survivable, there are bacteria. Eukaryotic has that EU prefix, which means true or good. And so eukaryotic cells are named literally for having a true nucleus, whereas prokaryotic cells don't have a true nucleus. That's the basis of the name, but that's not the only difference between these cells. That's just why they're named that. First, though, what is a true nucleus? Well, a true nucleus is enclosed by its own membrane. Now, every cell, prokaryotic or eukaryotic, is defined by a membrane, the membrane that surrounds the entire cell, which is called either the cell membrane or the plasma membrane. And that really defines the cell because that's the boundary between the cell and the rest of the universe. That's what makes each cell, in essence, a little test tube in which the peculiar chemistry is occurring that we call life. Now, prokaryotic cells, like all cells, have a plasma membrane, but for prokaryotic cells, that's the only membrane that they have. Excuse me. Now, eukaryotic cells have a plasma membrane, but they also have other membranes, including a couple membranes that surround the nucleus and therefore define it as a true nucleus. All right? The nucleus is an example. If you think back to the hierarchy of biological organization we talked about last time, the nucleus is an example of an organelle, which is a word that really means like a little organ within the cell. Of course, a true organ is part of a multicellular organism. An organelle is like an organ in a cell. It's not the only one. We'll go through all the organelles. But more than that, the nucleus is not only an organelle. It is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. Now, I should point out that there are two phrases that sound very similar but mean different things. Membrane-bound and membrane-bounded are two different things. And sometimes membrane-bound is misused even by textbooks, which kind of pisses me off. But bounded is the past tense of bound, which means to surround, form a boundary with. Okay? Some organelles are membrane-bounded, which means enclosed by their own membrane. And the nucleus is a good example of that. It is a membrane-bounded organelle. Later, I'll be using the phrase membrane-bound, In that case, bound is the past tense of bind, which means connect to or tie to. And in that sense, membrane bound means connected to a membrane, not enclosed by a membrane. So we'll be talking about membrane bound proteins, which are proteins embedded in the membrane. Okay? Here I'm saying membrane bounded. Anyway, all eukaryotic cells, well, I shouldn't say it that way. A eukaryotic cell is a cell that has a true and therefore membrane bounded nucleus. That is the basis for the word eukaryotic. It means true nucleus. But like I said a little bit earlier, that's not the only difference between a eukaryotic cell and a prokaryotic cell. Not only does a prokaryotic cell not have a membrane-bounded nucleus, it doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles either. And conversely, a eukaryotic cell not only has a membrane-bounded nucleus, it also has other membrane-bounded organelles. Things like mitochondrion, chloroplast, endoplasmic reticulum. We'll go through the list and look at them in detail later. All right? Now, an important result of this is that any given prokaryotic cell with its single membrane, the plasma membrane, is really only a single compartment. Everything that's inside that prokaryotic cell's plasma membrane is in the same compartment, right? There's only one compartment. And all the stuff that fills that is collectively called the cytoplasm. You see a prokaryotic cell here to also show you another difference. There's exceptions to these, but on average, prokaryotic cells are much smaller than eukaryotic cells. On average, about 1/10 the size in each of the three dimensions. That means in terms of volume, it's 1/10 of 1/10 of 1/10 the volume, right? So it's 1/1000th of the... You can fit 1,000 bacteria in a typical eukaryotic cell, like your own cells. So the cytoplasm is all the stuff inside any given prokaryotic cell. A eukaryotic cell, though, by virtue of it having membrane-bounded organelles, additional membranes besides the plasma membrane, is compartmentalized within the cell itself. The nucleus, what's inside that membrane, which is called the nuclear envelope, that is its own compartment compared to the stuff that's outside of the nucleus but still inside the cell. All right? This compartmentalization that eukaryotic cells evolved to become the eukaryotes of the world gives even more specificity of function to these different organelles. They're like little test tubes within the test tube, separated. You know, you have different compartments with different chemistry going on. So, whereas cytoplasm is everything inside a prokaryotic cell, the cytoplasm for a eukaryotic cell is the stuff that's inside the cell, but outside of all the other membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus. The brownish background here in the eukaryotic cell is cytoplasm, but this stuff inside the nucleus is its own stuff. It's called the nucleoplasm. Literally, plasm just means stuff. It's the stuff inside the nucleus. All right, let's go to 7. I'm going to talk a little bit about cell theory, what is called cell theory, which says that cells come only from pre-existing cells. It's a major tenet of what we call cell theory. That means cells don't, any longer at least, just come into existence without a cell there giving rise to that cell. To get a new cell, you have to start with a cell already. Now, of course, this can't have always been true, right? Because go back far enough, there were no cells. The original cells, which are the ancestors to all living things, those cells did come into existence without being created by pre-existing cells, because they were the first cells. And we'll talk a little bit about how that happened. But since then, for billions of years, in other words, which is life's history, all cells come only from pre-existing cells. And really what your body is, your trillions of cells that you call yourself, those are really just a continuation of billions of years of cells reproducing new cells, right? You didn't just pop into existence as a zygote. That zygote that you started as came from pre-existing cells, the sperm and egg of your parents, and so on, all the way back to the original successful cells roughly 4 billion years ago. Usually when cells come from pre-existing cells, it's a splitting. So one cell will split into two new cells. And that's how you became a multicellular organism after you started as a zygote, right? The zygote split into two, and then four, and then eight, and so on. Here in slide seven, we have kind of an unusual situation, although it happens all the time, where two cells actually fuse into one. And that's where your zygote came from. Sperm from the father, egg from the mother, fused into one cell. They were independent cells originally. And that one cell then split into two and four and eight and became a multicellular human. Now, for the unicellular organisms of the world, there is also splitting. A bacterium reproduces asexually by splitting into two new cells. Notice that's a little bit different from how we do things, because when a bacterium reproduces, it no longer exists, right? The bacterium that did exist now is two new cells. The original one is no longer there. The mother, on the other hand, a human mother, will still exist if all things go well after the pregnancy. It's just a new person. Okay, anyway, that's cell theory. Slide 8. Now, I suspect that everyone recognizes this as DNA, even though it's labeled. Probably knew that anyway, because DNA is by far the most famous molecule in the world nowadays. We've known about it for not actually all that long a time. It's long, you know, it's beyond your entire lifetimes, but that's not really all that long a time in terms of the history of science. Truly important molecule to life. You know, the reason that we have the situation where cells come from pre-existing cells is because of some remarkable properties of DNA. Namely, DNA has the ability to make exact copies of itself. And that's important when one cell splits into two, because each living cell requires its own DNA, and it requires a full set of DNA. Therefore, if you're going to turn one cell into two, you first need to duplicate the DNA that was there originally, so you have enough for two different cells. And DNA is able to do that for reasons we'll get deeper into later in the term. Actually, about half of the term, the whole second half of the term, will be in one way or another about DNA. All those chapters will involve DNA in some case. Right now, all I want to say about DNA, other than what I've said, is that it is an example of one of four categories of macromolecules that all organisms are made out of. Now, a macromolecule, as the name indicates, is a big molecule compared to smaller things. Now, organisms are made out of big and small molecules. We have a lot of water molecules in us, for instance. Those are not big molecules. Neither is an oxygen molecule or carbon dioxide molecule. But if you look at the organelles that cells are made out of, those are made out of mostly large molecules or macromolecules, and specifically organic macromolecules, carbon-containing macromolecules. Well, I mentioned a bit ago that there are four of these, four categories. Anyone know these four categories? All organisms contain all four. They're all vitally important to life. So you can't do without any of the four. And it's the same four for whether you're talking about bacteria, an archaean, a giraffe, us. Any ideas what they are? Three of them are known as nutrient classes. So you see these on as categories on food labels all the time.
Protein
is one.
Vitamin D.
That is a subclass. It's not one of the four major categories. Proteins is one, though.
Carbs?
I'm not going to accept... I always get this as an answer. I'm not going to accept carbohydrates as an answer because it's too broad a term. Carbohydrates don't have to be large. They don't have to be macromolecules. And I'm talking about biological macromolecules. Now, there are some macromolecules that are carbohydrates, and those are a subset of carbohydrates. What do we call the large carbohydrates? Glucose, for instance, is a carbohydrate, but it's not big. No. You're getting into a different category. Glucose is an example of a carbohydrate, but it's not a macromolecule. If you take a hell of a lot of glucoses and hook them together, you make a big sugar, big carbohydrate called either glycogen or starch, depending on what kind of organism is making it. What are those examples of? That's one of the categories. Starch and glycogen are examples of polysaccharides. Glucose is a monosaccharide and it is small. Large carbohydrates are called polysaccharides, so that's one of the four. Okay? Proteins, polysaccharides, lipids is the third. And I'm going to ask you this question probably six times this term, so remember to get these answers quick in answering me eventually. And then the fourth is nucleic acids. And DNA is an example of a nucleic acid. In fact, that's what the NA of DNA stands for. There are two major categories of nucleic acids, one of which is deoxyribonucleic acid. That's what DNA specifically stands for. And RNA, which is ribonucleic acid. They are both informational molecules. But DNA has some properties that are different from RNA that we'll get into. You probably already have a feel for what DNA does. I mean, I could ask someone off the street who's never had a biology course what DNA is for, and what would they say, or what would you say? Yeah. It is the genetic makeup, and what does that mean? What does the genetic makeup do for you? Yes, but only indirectly. It is a code. DNA contains codes called genes, which is what genetic is the adjective of, right? Of genes. The genes that are made of DNA, genes are just DNA. The codes that are carried by genes, we often say, give us our traits. That's actually only indirectly true. DNA codes for how to make RNA molecules. That's its direct job. RNA codes, it gets the code then from DNA, and then RNA codes tells the cell how to build proteins. And it's proteins, a totally different category of macromolecules, one of those four I said. It's proteins that actually directly give you your traits. So you look the way you do, you think the way you do, you smell the way you do, you're able to do the things you're able to do because of proteins, the specific proteins that you, your cells, know how to make. Now there are limitless, the effectively unlimited number of possible proteins that could be built if you were designing things. Your cells, though, don't know how to make any kind of protein on their own. They have to be given instructions. And those instructions start out as your genes. You're stuck with those genes unless you get them manipulated somehow or unless they mutate. which is why you are stuck with only a certain set of proteins that you're able to make, and that's why you have your traits. If you were able to change your genes, you would be able to make additional different proteins, and you would have additional traits. But it's the proteins that give you your traits, it's DNA that indirectly gives you your traits by coding for those proteins. And in this picture, we're looking at the middle cartoon of the double helical structure of DNA. We'll look deeper at this later. But really, DNA, what we call ADNA, is really two molecules. It's two polynucleotides, which is another name for a nucleic acid. Let me just quickly go through this again. The four categories were protein, nucleic acid, lipid, and polysaccharides. Now, polysaccharides, that name tells you that it's made of many parts. Poly means many, mono means one. So a polysaccharide is an example of a polymer. A polymer is not only a large molecule, but it's a large molecule that's built by hooking together a bunch of small parts, which are called monomers. All right? So glucose is a monomer, a monosaccharide. It's a monomer that can be used to build a polymer called starch, a polysaccharide. Proteins is one of those categories. Well, protein is also a polymer. It's made of monomers called amino acids. Now, another name for a protein is not a polyamino acid. It's a polypeptide because the bonds between amino acids are called peptide bonds. So you can use those. You can call a protein a polypeptide. And the third of the four that are polymers are nucleic acids. And nucleic acids are built by hooking together monomers called nucleotides, which is why another name for a nucleic acid is a polynucleotide, many nucleotides big. A polynucleotide is a long string of some number of nucleotides. It can be millions long. Well, what we call ADNA is really two polynucleotides, each its own molecule, really, but they're held together in a special way that I'll talk about to form the overall double helix. A helix is a corkscrew shape. And since you have two of them doing this at the same time, it's a double helix, and it really has a twisted ladder structure. What's shown on the right side of the screen, though, is just one of those two polynucleotides that's in DNA. This is one strand, in other words. There's another one that would be right beside it. And this has been untwisted, and you can see that it looks like half a ladder. If you had the other half, you would have just a ladder. But these A's, T's, C's, and G's, those are what gives DNA its information. And that's enough to say about it right now. We'll look much deeper into DNA later. Slide 9. One really important aspect of biology or of remaining alive is homeostasis. Homeostasis is a word that means staying the same. Stasis is staying, and homeo means the same. Now, there's all kinds of aspects to homeostasis, which I think we kind of got into last time, didn't we? Homeostasis is necessary for life, meaning organisms will die if homeostasis is not maintained. Remember, homeostasis is maintenance of a relatively constant internal environment. Conditions need to be maintained, or the organism will die. Well, that doesn't just automatically happen. There has to be a mechanism in place to maintain homeostasis. There's many aspects of homeostasis. Last time I think I used thermostasis as an example, maintenance of body temperature. That one's nice and easy to understand. So I'll just use that again. But in any case of homeostasis, we're dealing with variables. A variable is anything that can vary, right? Just like in math. So biological conditions that can vary are variables. Temperature is an example of a variable. But for any given variable, there is a so-called set point. A set point is the, in a sense, the desired value, the ideal value for that variable. So your brain has a set point for your body temperature. What it wants the body to be at is the set point. Okay, that's the desired value. That doesn't mean the temperature is at that value at any given moment, right? It could be higher or lower. Now, it can't be much higher or much lower, or you're dead, and that's the importance of homeostasis. But there's a set point. That's the goal, in a sense. And then there's the actual value at the moment. Whatever your body temperature is the actual value. Therefore, for any given variable, like temperature, you can compute an error. An error is simply the difference between the set point, the desired value, and the actual value. Right, you just subtract one from the other, you get the error. Notice that if you are exactly at set point, the error is zero, which is right where the brain wants you to be. Right, that's perfect homeostasis if you remained at zero. Well, it never remains at zero because conditions around you are continuously changing. And that's going to make your body temperature a little higher or lower. But because of mechanisms that organisms have, that variable is not allowed to get too far away from set point. To do that, though, to maintain a variable close to set point requires a mechanism called feedback. There are two major categories of feedback, and they are called positive feedback and negative feedback. But importantly, only one of these two feedback mechanisms is ever able to lead to homeostasis. That's negative feedback. It's the only homeostatic feedback mechanism. Positive feedback never will lead to homeostasis, for reasons I'll explain when I tell you why negative feedback works. Think about the word negative in the phrase negative feedback, first of all. Negative is the adjective of negate, which means to get rid of, right? The desire here, if you want to think about it in terms of goals, is to negate the error. You want to get rid of the error, which is the same thing as saying you want to get that variable exactly to set point, in which case there would be no error, it would be zero. So negative feedback is called that for that reason. Negative feedback always reduces the error, which brings the variable closer to set point. And notice that it happens that way whether the variable is too high or it's too low. So I don't want you to think that negative feedback is used if the variable is is wrong in one direction and positive feedback is used in the other direction. That's not at all the case. Regardless of which direction, too high or too low, the variable is, only negative feedback can get it back. And that's why it's called negative feedback. All right? Positive feedback always makes the error worse. So whatever the error is, if it's already too high, positive feedback will make it even higher, going farther away from set point. And that's why it can never lead to homeostasis. Because of this, nearly all feedback mechanisms in living organisms are negative feedback mechanisms. They are the ones that are homeostatic. There are some feedback mechanisms that are positive. They're just vastly outnumbered by negative feedback mechanisms. Classic example that almost all textbooks give for positive feedback is parturition, which is just another name for childbirth. If a woman is about to give birth, and if the fetus is positioned normally with the head facing downward, that head starts to stretch on the cervix, which is the narrow part of the uterus. And the stretching of that cervix causes signals to be sent to the brain via nerves. The brain responds to the stretching by releasing a hormone called oxytocin. That gets put into the bloodstream and travels to all parts of the body, including the uterus. The uterus has the right receptors for the oxytocin, so it gets the message, and the oxytocin tells the uterus, not the cervix, but the blind-ended part, the fundus at the top of the uterus, to contract, to squeeze, which forces the fetus farther down, making the head stretch the cervix even more, so the error gets worse. That sends an even stronger signal to the brain, which responds by releasing even more oxytocin, so it's a vicious circle, right? And contraction is even stronger, and then eventually, after a few rounds of this, out pops the kid if things go correctly. all positive feedback mechanisms have to be temporary. And once they're done, regular negative feedback mechanisms will reestablish homeostasis. Here we see negative feedback at work in slide 9 at the top, using a biochemical pathway as an example. Now, it doesn't matter what A, B, and C, and D are. They're chemicals. But they're made in stepwise. A gets turned into B in one reaction, then B into C, and C into D. D is the final product. And whatever it is, the cell needs it certain times. Okay, so if there isn't enough D, then it makes sense to turn that pathway on, right? Because the cell needs the D. If the cell, as more and more D gets produced, if the cell uses it up, keeps using it because it keeps needing it, then it will, that pathway will remain on. But eventually, the cell will have as much D as it needs already. And if the pathway continues to make more D, it will start to build up, right? That's an error. Too much D. You have more than the set point amount, right? So in this case, D itself, whatever molecule that is, starts interfering with the first enzyme in this pathway. The enzyme is a molecule acting as a catalyst that allows A to be converted into B. So if you interfere with that first enzyme, you don't get past that first step, and therefore you shut down the entire pathway, right? D stops being made, which is exactly the correct response if you already have too much D. So it feeds back to an earlier part of the process, that's why it's called feedback, and it shuts it down. Later, when the cell needs D again, it will start using what's already piled up, and when it's used all of the D, some of which is interfering with enzyme 1, it will stop interfering because the cell will use it up, and therefore it'll turn this back on automatically. That's negative feedback. Positive feedback, on the other hand, would just keep producing more and more Z in this example too. All right, is the difference clear? Let's go to 10 then. Here we're looking at a schematic representation of taxonomy. Taxonomy is a type of classification of organisms. Its name is based on a taxon, which is a word by itself, just means a group. It's kind of a general term. We group things together based on certain similarities in taxonomy. And just like the hierarchy of biological organization from biosphere down to atoms that we talked about last time, taxonomy is also hierarchical. Large taxa contain multiple smaller taxa. Each of those taxa, T-A-X-A is the plural. Each of those taxa, in turn, contain multiple smaller taxa still. And that's why we have, you probably have heard kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Those are all taxa. Well, those were the only taxa that existed back when I was first learned classification 40 years ago or whatever. Kingdoms were the biggest things, and there were only 5. There were started out only being 2 before I was born, but they eventually made 5 kingdoms. Since then, kingdoms, there's many more than 5 kingdoms, and they're no longer even the biggest groups, the biggest taxa. Now, the largest and therefore most inclusive, including the most things, taxa are the domains. And there are 3 domains that collectively contain all organisms that have ever existed. 3 domains are huge groups. But each domain contains a certain number of kingdoms, each kingdom contains a certain number of phyla, and so on, all the way down to species. We can see the domains in slide 11. Each box represents a domain, and they're labeled here. Notice that the 3 domains are bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. Now, which one of these do we belong to? That's not a domain. Yes, we are animals. But which domain?
Eukarya.
Which you probably have guessed is named for the fact that it includes the eukaryotic cells. Organisms that have eukaryotic cells are called eukaryotes, members of eukarya. But whereas there is a dichotomy of cell type that we just discussed at the beginning of this, right, prokaryotic and eukaryotic, notice that there is not a domain called prokarya. There's a domain called eukarya, and that includes only eukaryotes. Moreover, it includes all eukaryotes that have ever existed. All eukaryotes and only eukaryotes. The prokaryotic organisms of the world are in one or the other of the two remaining domains. There are some that are in bacteria, some that are in archaea. Now, you probably have guessed what things are included in bacteria. The bacteria. All the bacteria of the world are in their own domain. And archaeans, which are members of archaea, if you were to look at them under a microscope, you wouldn't really be able to tell them apart from members of bacteria. They're not only fellow prokaryotes, they don't have a nucleus or any other membrane-bounded organelles, but they also just look alike under light microscopy. But there are very important chemical differences which justify putting them in their own domain. Okay, so the original lineages of successful cells that were not only successfully came into existence, but were the first to successfully create new cells, you know, that's our true ancestors. That was before any of these. Well, that lineage then eventually split into bacteria and archaea, and then split again to create eukarya much later on. Slide 12. Did I skip one? Okay. Slide 12 is just a cartoon example of the fact that despite huge differences in organisms, for instance, a paramecium, which is a unicellular eukaryote, and a human with its a cell from a windpipe in a human, really, there's a hell of a lot of differences between a paramecium and a human. Despite those huge differences, though, there's commonalities as well. Ciliated cells from these two drastically different organisms at the molecular level are remarkably similar, and that's because we have shared ancestry. That's what taxonomy is based on, shared ancestry. So the eukaryotes of the world are all members of eukarya, because they all are descendants from the same ancestor that split off of that original lineage. Okay, 13. We talked a little bit about evolution last time, and specifically we were talking about the fact that it's important as part of the definition of life, right? Living things undergo adaptive evolution. What did I say is the only adaptive mechanism of evolution? Yeah.
Natural selection.
And that's exactly what we're looking at a simple example of in 13. The black background here represents the environment. And this population of beetles, like any natural population, has individual variation. They're not all identical in their traits. And the trait we really care about here is their coloration. You know, there are lighter colored ones, there are darker colored ones, because they have different versions of DNA, even though they're the same species. Well, the bird here is a predator who wants to eat these things. Doesn't care anything about biology, but just out for a meal. And naturally occurring organisms, it's important for them to spend as little energy as possible because, you know, most things are on this brink of starvation at any given moment. They don't want to waste any energy. So it's not going to say, I really want light-colored or I really want dark-colored beetles. It's just going to go for the ones it sees, right, that it easily sees. And so if these beetles are living on a dark-colored background, like dark tree bark, for instance, then the light ones that just got dealt that genetic hand that makes them light-colored, those are going to stand out a lot easier to the bird, right? The darker ones are going to be more likely to evade being eaten because they're more camouflaged. So that means a higher percentage of light-colored ones will be eaten, and therefore, since they're dead, not pass on their genes, which are genes for lightness, to the next generation. The dark ones will pass their genes on because they won't have been eaten, but not as many of them will. So the next generation will be constructed of individuals with a higher percentage dark and a lower percentage light. That's evolution by definition. All right, and it's adaptive evolution because it makes the population from generation to generation better fit, better suited to the conditions under which that population lives. Assuming that it continues to be dark, right? Real environments continuously change, which is why evolution never produces a perfectly fit individual, or species, I mean. It's because the environment is continuously changing, so natural selection selects things differently as the environment changes. And there's a famous example of something just like this. Light-colored background in certain insects was what they were naturally living on, so the dark ones were sitting ducks. Then the Industrial Revolution came along, and we were burning so much coal that soot was actually blackening the bark. And that didn't change the environment to favor the black-colored ones, and so now they evolved into mostly black ones. But that's natural selection. 14. This overall tree that we're looking at is an example of what we call a phylogeny. Or we can call it a phylogenetic tree. This is just a tiny part of what would be an overall enormously big tree of life that would go back to one common ancestor that I've talked about already, the original successful cells. That's the trunk that is common to the entire tree of life. But we're looking at just a little bit of the tree that involves just these birds right here. But this is also a hierarchical or nested arrangement. The reason these trees are drawn this way, and you'll learn more about this in 182, is that each of these places where a lineage, which are these lines, splits into two, is where new species are created by natural selection. And we group these things together based on their common ancestor. So in any given place where you have something splitting into two, those two groups are more closely related to each other than either of them is to anything else in the tree, because they split from a common ancestor just recently. All right, that's how phylogenies are constructed. And so there's a big tree for all of eukaryotes, there's a big tree for all of bacteria, there's a big tree for all of archaea, the three domains, and those are all hooked together and part of the overall tree of life. Okay, 15. This might be the last slide of this chapter, I'm not sure, but this is just a quick rundown of the scientific process, which you might have learned in other courses. Science is fundamentally different. There's two major ways of looking at the world, basically. There is science and there's faith, and they are fundamentally different. Science is based on evidence. If there is no evidence, then you're not really talking about science. Faith, on the other hand, is belief in something without any evidence, and in fact, sometimes belief in something despite evidence to the contrary. Faith is belief because you want to believe it. There doesn't have to be evidence. And that's not scientific at all, right? Now, you might want to believe something scientifically, but if there really isn't evidence for it, then you're not being scientific. You're being faithful instead. And the scientific method is a way of amassing evidence and formulating or forming what we call facts. You know, there are facts that we say are true. We don't really know anything for absolute certainty. But what we call facts, like gravity or evolution, those are just things that continuously stand up against the test to prove them wrong. It doesn't mean, though, that they are absolutely true, just like Newtonian mechanics, which Newton was, it's named after Newton, defines how things move around. That was considered fact for a long time. And in fact, it's still close enough to the truth that since it's simpler than quantum mechanics, which has superseded it since then, is still taught. Until you get to higher science courses do you actually get into quantum mechanics, which is now the fact. The point is, what we say are facts changes. And it changes because science tells us it has to change, because there is evidence. In other words, it would be faithful to continue to say Newtonian mechanics is absolutely true, now that we know it's not true when you test it certain ways. It's true, it's close enough macroscopically, but when you get down to a tiny microscopic level, Newtonian mechanics no longer works. Quantum mechanics does, and that's why we call it the truth now. But anyway, let's talk about the scientific method. Science involves observation. We're just naturally curious animals, so we notice things about the world. In this simple example, this woman is noticing that the flashlight doesn't work. Observations then lead to questions, because we're also naturally inquisitive. The question here that is inspired by the observation that the light doesn't work is, why doesn't it work? Well, this leads then to hypotheses. And hypotheses and predictions are two things that students mix up all the time. Think about this linguistically. A hypothesis is an explanation. It's a declarative sentence said in such a way as though it's pretending it's true. Now, not all hypotheses are true, but when you state a hypothesis, you're stating it as though it is true. So you would say, the flashlight doesn't work because, an important word in a hypothesis, because it shows that it's an explanation. The light doesn't work because the battery is dead. That's a hypothesis, one of many possible hypotheses. Okay, but when you state that, you're saying this is the truth. You don't really know yet whether it is the truth. Prediction, on the other hand, is about future, right? And it will include words like will. Well, a hypothesis, once you come up with a hypothesis logically leads to a prediction. A prediction is something that will come true if the hypothesis is true. Okay, so if and will are important words in predictions. If you have the hypothesis that the battery is dead, explaining the light being out, then the logically corresponding prediction is, if I put in a fresh battery, the light will work again. That's a prediction. Okay, you see the difference linguistically between the two? On the other hand, if you have the alternative hypothesis that the light doesn't work because the filament on the incandescent bulb is out, it's broken, then the corresponding prediction is, if I change the light bulb, it will go on. Okay, that's part of science, the scientific process. Predictions then, which lead naturally, logically from hypotheses, themselves logically lead to ways of testing those predictions, which we call in science experiments. So an experiment is simply a way of formally testing whether the predictions corresponding to a hypothesis will come true or not. And there's two possible outcomes. It will come true or it won't, right? Now let's say that a prediction does not come true. So you change the battery, the light is still out. What does that mean for the hypothesis? It means that you have refuted the hypothesis. We can refute hypotheses. Because you've, assuming that you made no mistake in the experiment, you've shown that the hypothesis must not be right, at least not partially right, because the corresponding prediction did not come true. That's what experimentation is. What, though, if the prediction comes true? What does that mean? No, actually. If a prediction comes out correct, then that means scientifically that the hypothesis could be correct. It doesn't necessarily mean it's correct. For instance, there could be a loose wire, right? And I'm replacing a good battery with another good battery. If I, in that process, jiggle the wire and get it to back so it's continuous again, the light will go on, but not because of the battery. So all we can do is bolster a hypothesis, say that we haven't refuted it. It could become correct. And that's why you don't do an experiment once. You do it over and over. And the more and more the predictions become true, the closer and closer we get to accepting that as the truth. And that's how we come to have facts, because test after test, it doesn't fail. For things like gravity and evolution. Those are facts. Okay, that's one chapter.